Well, welcome to Week to Week, the political roundtable from the Commonwealth Club of California for Monday, August 17th, 2015. This, by the way, was the week in which Hillary Clinton joked with Iowans that she loves her new Snapchat account because, quote, those messages disappear all by themselves, unquote. So thanks for joining us here in San Francisco. I'm John Zipperer, your host for Week to Week and the Commonwealth Club's Vice President of Media and Editorial. I would like to mention that we are heading back to Silicon Valley next month for our next Week to Week. It's going to be on Tuesday, September 15th. We hope you will join us for that program. It'll be right before the Republican candidates gather for their next big debate, so it'll be fun. Also, shortly before that Week to Week, we're going to have our first candidate of the presidential season speaking at the Commonwealth Club here in San Francisco. It's going to be Dr. Ben Carson, who you might have seen is currently in second place on the GOP. So that's going to be Tuesday, September 8th. And your laughter, I know.
No way.
You agree with those
polls. Nobody
those
predicted
polls.
That. You're lying if you think you predicted. That's not true.
Okay. So on today's program, we are going to talk about some new developments in homeless policy and politics, the latest from the rollicking 2016 presidential race, California's difficult road politics, as well as some environmental issues in the Golden State, as well as quite a bit more local, state, and national news. So, of course, the Commonwealth Club of California is a place for people of a very wide range of views. So any opinions that are expressed here are those solely of the speakers and not of the Commonwealth Club. Now let's meet our panels for today. I'm going to start on the far end of the stage with Melissa Griffin Kane. She's a contributor to CBS San Francisco, as well as San Francisco Magazine. She's an attorney, and she's on Twitter at MelissaKane1. Next to her is Chuck Nevius, longtime columnist with the San Francisco Chronicle. He's on Twitter at CWNevius. And next to me is Carson Bruno, a research fellow at the Hoover Institution, where he specializes in California's political and policy landscape, and he's on Twitter at CarsonJFBruno. So please use the question cards that are spread throughout the room to write down any questions. I will, as always, try to ask as many as possible during this program. Now on to our roundtable. I wanted to start off with homelessness, and that is kind of one of those perennial issues or eternal issues, unfortunately. But it's in the news. I don't know if you saw this story, but recently the U.S. Justice Department filed a notice that states its belief that cities cannot ban people from sleeping in public spaces. Part of the comment was, quote, sleeping is a life-sustaining activity. In other words, it must occur at some time in some place, and therefore cities can't prevent people from doing so in public. Now, cities have been trying many different strategies with homelessness over the years, from, you remember, the Giuliani years, the get-tough policy in New York, so-called, the Utah city that provided housing for all of its homeless people. And then there's San Francisco, which tries to do a mixture of services. Melissa, you're our legal eagle on this panel. Mm-hmm. So what can you tell us about the Justice Department's thinking? And will it have any effect, or was that just kind of a statement in the wind?
Well, to be fair, whoa, I don't want to yell at you. To be clear, this is a case that goes back to 2009. It originates in Idaho. Boise, Idaho had this ordinance that prohibited people from sleeping and on any public property at any time. So I want to understand that that's a distinction from what we have in San Francisco, where what we ban is sitting and lying on public sidewalks between 7 a.m. and 11 p.m. So ideally, it allows for, or maybe not ideally, but it could allow for someone to sleep on a public sidewalk from the hours of 11 p.m. to 7 a.m. So ours is not an ordinance that is just like theirs, right? Theirs just said anytime you're sleeping anywhere on public property, it's a problem. And so this law was challenged, of course, and again, this is 2009. It's taken 5 years, and it's just a bunch of legal wrangling, blah, blah, blah. So we get down to like this final moment of, how do we determine, what's legal and what's not. And what the Justice Department basically said is this: what you're doing is you're banning a status, right? Legally speaking, you can't ban a status. You can't say it's illegal to be a drug addict, right? That's a status. You can say it's illegal to possess drugs, but it's not illegal to be a drug addict. And that's kind of what we're talking about, like an action versus a status. And so what the Justice Department is saying is that what you're doing is not really just banning an action, you're really banning a status, right? It's akin to an addict or someone who's living in a certain state. It doesn't have anything to do with their actions. And the reason this is an important distinction to make is because there are questions that come up, and that because you say, well, there's lots of things that people have to do to survive. They have to eat, they have to pee. You know, there's all sorts of things that that people do in public that we try to ban or curtail. How far does this go in terms of like what we're allowed to do in public spaces? The reason I'm bringing this up is because it really is pretty limited. Right, it really is pretty limited to a situation where the state of not having a home is the problem, not the state of like really having to go to the bathroom, right? That's not like a protected class or an issue. So it will probably be more limited to this case in places that have these kinds of really sweeping laws that say nowhere, no time. This is a problem for them. Again, not a problem for us. So I don't think we're going to be seeing like a major upending of all, you know, homelessness policy.
Okay. Chuck, you've been writing a lot about homeless issues here in San Francisco.
I have. As we know, it's a target-rich environment here for a columnist in San Francisco, so homelessness is a big part of it. And what I would say is this is an example of theory and practice. And in theory, every one of us who sees someone, there's a guy who sleeps by the Chronicle, he doesn't even have a blanket. I mean, I see him curled up in a fetal position on the sidewalk, and you say, that guy has got to get some help. But I also know, having gone out with the homeless outreach team, that it's not a myth that you can say to someone, would you like to go to a shelter tonight? And they say, no, I don't want to. I'm going to stay right here. And the reasons are they may have a partner. They can't have their partner with them in a shelter. They may have a dog. They may want to drink or do drugs. They may not want to get out at 6 in the morning. You know, not long ago in Sacramento, an assemblywoman put forth a bill called Right to Rest. And it was very similar to this, in the idea that you can't restrict someone who's homeless from just resting anywhere. What we found out later was that she came from the mean streets of Pasadena. And what we would like to do is bring her to San Francisco and say, well, take a look at this, because we've got a much different situation. So I think much has been made of it, but I think Melissa's dead on. It's not going to affect San Francisco. And we're right here, again, theory, practice. We're right here in the practice. And we are, in San Francisco, making an immense effort, $167 million just right off the top for homelessness. So it's not as if we're not trying to treat the problem, but it is a very thorny, difficult problem. And with all due respect to the Department of Justice, I don't think you understand the problem.
Carson, is this solely a city matter? Does the state have... Does it do anything on homelessness? Is that a role for them?
I think it's an area where the state can have a lot more impact. It's been a few years now where the mental health surtax has been added on to the tax code for taxing the millionaires in the state. We know from a report just last year or 2 years ago that money has been not used properly or effectively in trying to get more people into mental health facilities and the care that they really do need. And doing that effectively and efficiently could definitely help a lot of communities and cities because that is one of the main causes for the homelessness problem.
Absolutely.
So it's definitely something that Sacramento could be doing more, paying attention to, making sure the money is spent wisely, and helping and being a partner with cities like San Francisco and Los Angeles and many others, Fresno being another one that has a big problem. In trying to fix the situation, trying to figure out what are the causes and getting rid of those causes. There was a bill a few years ago that tried to give the homeless rights to essentially property rights to the streets. Aiding, making it easier to be on the streets is not really the best way to actually fix the problems that these people really have, whether it is mental health
issues.
That
was Tom Amiano, right?
Yes, it was.
That was our guy.
Yeah. It was.
The Homeless Bill of Rights.
And it didn't go very far.
Nope.
Because, you know, even the most progressive in the state legislature realized, you know, that's not really the problem. The problem are all these little things that are contributing to their state.
And I think more importantly, it's not the solution. And I would say one thing, and that is that I think it's undeniable that San Francisco is making a switch. And the fact that, you know, a lot of people from the left and the progressives are saying that it's gentrification, I think they're right. It's very difficult for people to live in San Francisco in this day and age. But The people who are moving into San Francisco, and I was just saying in the green room, I went to a neighborhood meeting in Mission Bay where I live. And there were a group of people who had purchased million-dollar condominiums, who were paying $4,000 and $5,000 for an apartment, and they were at this meeting with the captain of the Southern Police Station, and they were saying, "Do you realize that there are homeless people in our neighborhood right now?" And luckily, my wife held me down, but I was going to get up and, "Where have you people been? We know that, yes, yes." But you want to talk about a squeaky wheel, those people, and, you know, I'm a member of Mission Bay, but there are going to be complaints, and they're going to stick with it. And I think there are fewer and fewer places that are sort of accepted campgrounds for the homeless in San Francisco, and we're going to have some kind of reckoning. And I don't know what it's going to be, but it's definitely the idea of New York with these. They have different. New York has set up a series of smaller shelters where you can go and live with your partner and with your dog and take your possessions. But that's the deal. You're either on the street, and we don't want you on the street, you have to leave, or you can go to the shelter. You can leave or you can go to the shelter. That's it. And as Trent Rohr from our Department of Health says, they don't even give you a ride. They just give you a bus schedule and say, this is how you get there. And, you know.
The shelters are also in, like, the Bronx, Market Street.
Exactly. They're not between the prime shopping area in San Francisco and City Hall as it is in San Francisco. So change is coming. It'll be interesting to see how it plays out. And we definitely want to continue to be compassionate. But it's going to be a very interesting 5 years.
One thing I think, I don't know if this is happening in other cities, but you especially drive along Mission underneath the overpasses, you see a lot of tents. Now, is this compassionate outreach? Is this a city? Is this social groups? I mean, what's going on with that? Because a lot of those tents look alike.
There is a conspiracy theory that someone is handing out tents because, again, Trent Rohr, who is as good as anybody in the United States on homelessness, said, "I have never seen so many tents in my life." And if you look, a lot of them are the same tent. A lot of them are blue with an orange rain fly. So I don't know if somebody's giving them out or the guy. We talked to someone the other day, and he said Target is selling tents for a low price, so maybe that's it. But the urban camping thing is going to be very tough to sustain, and I think that we're about to have a reckoning with that, and it could get ugly.
This is San Francisco, so those tents probably will rent for about $3,500 a month. Well, let's talk about presidential politics, because that is pretty exciting to watch these days. And we're not going to start with the guy whose name rhymes with Ronald Slump. We're going to start with independent Senator Bernie Sanders, who is, at best, he's Democrat-ish. He's not a member of the party, but he's running for its nomination. And he's giving Hillary Clinton a spirited race for votes, pulled ahead of her in at least one early voting state poll that we've all seen. Carson, talk about Sanders' campaign. What's its popularity, its challenges? What's he doing?
Well, I definitely think he is tapping into a very serious frustration amongst the progressive left across the country. Mm-hmm. They see, you know, Hillary Clinton is the epitome of the establishment, the Democratic machine. She's been around forever. So is Bernie Sanders. But he's very fresh. You know, people really didn't know who he was before he jumped in. He's saying a lot of things that the liberal left really likes, really wants to see. That they've been, you know, pining for years now. They were hopeful that President Obama would do a lot of these things, and then, you know, he has to pull back, just given the nature of politics. But Bernie is saying the things that they want to say. In many ways, he's kind of the liberal version of what you're seeing kind of from the more anti-establishment Republicans. He can say the things that, you know, a Hillary Clinton can't say, just like, you know, the Ben Carsons, Ted Cruzes can say the things that Jeb Bush would never say but can't say either. So it's interesting to watch. You know, he's showing a lot of the Clinton campaign's weaknesses across the board. However, I would say I really think that his surge has plateaued. You kind of see him stalling out in a lot of the recent polls. And he does very well with well-educated white liberals. which is, you know, in Iowa, New Hampshire, that's who's showing up to the primaries and the caucuses. Once you get down to the South, that's not who's showing up to the Democratic primaries. So he can do well, I think, in pockets of this of the country. Minnesota might be one place, Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont, obviously, Massachusetts. But across the board, he doesn't have the staying power, support-wise, at least right now, to be able to kind of really do what Obama did to Clinton 8 years ago. That said, though, I think it's showing to a lot of people that Clinton's not necessarily the indomitable force that everyone thought she was going into this race. You're getting a lot of talk now about Biden jumping in, about Gore jumping in. Who's heard from Al Gore recently? But now he thinks he can get at it. You know, John Kerry just this past weekend said that he's not closing the door on elected politics.
John Kerry?
Oh my God.
So, you know, it's there's a lot of now people thinking, oh, wait
it's
a minute.
It's like Night of the Living Dead.
Can I actually beat Hillary? I think I might be able to. So, you know, who knows who actually ends up in. But Bernie's showing that that there's a hunkering for this, you know, liberal red meat, if you were.
Well, my method is to read other people and then steal their ideas and make it sound like they're mine. So here's what. So one of the things I read today was that, you know, this is very significant. In Iowa and in New Hampshire, Bernie Sanders is actually making a lot of inroads. And the Clinton people have to be very worried. But what this person was making the point was he's not cutting into her base that much. Nationally, she continues to have a very high approval rating in the 70s. But I think what Carson said is true, which is she seems so inauthentic. I get the impression she would say anything if that would help, you know, help the cause. Bernie Sanders is only going to say what Bernie Sanders is going to say, and I think it's a little bit of a Bullworth moment. We kind of like that guy who says those things, and who knows? I mean, if Iowa and New Hampshire go, I mean, if he makes a good showing there, We're gonna talk about him. But I think she's still got the money, she's still got the national reputation, and she's definitely got the organization. It's just, if you could just get over this idea that she's not a real person.
Little issue.
Is that sexist? Was that
we
bad?
Think you're a robot, was and that? We should work on that.
Is that bad to say?
No, it's okay. Yes, I, on behalf of all women, like, it's okay. You can say you think she's not that. Well, here's the thing, though, about Sanders is, you know, I've, we're all fascinated by him, but two things. Number one, the idea, the importance of winning in Iowa and New Hampshire is that donors will give you money and then you can win other elections elsewhere. Like Sanders, though, because of sort of the nature of what he stands for, is not going to be able to, you know, win in New Hampshire and then all of a sudden Goldman Sachs is going to start giving him money. Like, that's not ever going to happen. So even if he were to win in one of these early states, it's not clear that he would actually reap the benefits that usually come with winning in one of those early states where you build momentum and you buy more commercials and blah, blah, blah. So that's number one. And number two, if you think about the people who are coming to his rallies, a lot of them, even though they may not love Hillary Clinton, are going to really hate whatever Republican runs. So if you think about who's ever at his rally, they're, you know, so they're there and they're like, yay, Bernie, but it, like, let's assume she gets the nomination. They're still going to turn out and vote for her because the kind of person who's going to rally for Bernie Sanders is going to be appalled at a Ben Carson or a Ted Cruz or, you know, so it's not to say that she's going to, you know, that these people are going to turn their backs on her. I think ultimately, you know, assuming she does get the nomination, they will turn out for her, even if they have to hold their nose and just be like, I hate this person less, you know, which is how we vote in America, let's face it. So I still think that it's not really fatal to her sort of general election to have a good chunk rooting for him. And I think there are a number of people who are for him who are not antithetical to her. They want to pull her a little more to the left, and they want to sort of be right now casting a little bit of a protest vote, but that they will sort of fall in line when they need to, when it comes down to it.
What do you make of Senator Bernie Sanders' interactions with the Black Lives Matter movement? We've seen now twice, I think you've all seen this, they got a lot of attention, where events he was going to be speaking at, they weren't his campaign rallies, they were both events held by other people, but both times he was going to speak and they were taken over or interrupted by activists from Black Lives Matter, which is a very decentralized organization. It's not like they're all getting orders from Acorn Central. But what does this A, first of all, why are they going after him? I mean, we're talking about a very liberal senator who has been very vocal in his support for civil rights and other things. But B, does this, I mean, just to be the kind of the bloodless political question, does this help him? Does this hurt him? What do potential voters see when they see him standing there and someone else is taking the mic at an event?
Well, I think, number one, they do because they can, frankly, at his events. Like, the security is just not that good. They're kind of messy events. And, like, they tried to come to a Hillary Clinton event and they couldn't get past security. I mean, like, let's face it. I mean, the part of the thing about Bernie Sanders events is that they're just a little more freewheeling, and you can kind of get up there and comedy. Can you imagine, like, Hillary relinquishing the microphone to Black Lives Matter? Like, no. That is not going to happen. So, not to them, not to anyone. Part of it just is a matter of sort of there's an opportunity, and there's this person, and when they go up there, they got huge amounts of press. So it's like you sort of find the weak part of the fence, and you can get over there and sort of and get in there and get and really increase their message. Now, after they interrupted those Sanders events or those other events that he was at, they were able to get a private conference with Hillary Clinton. Now, it's not clear that that would have happened without that kind of coverage. So it's not to say that they were crazy for doing it. A lot of people question, you know, why are you targeting this, you know, this guy who's probably, you know, incredibly like the most sympathetic candidate for you. They were able to leverage that to get in to have bigger conversations with other candidates. So it does have some, I think, some rationale to it, even if, you know, ultimately it's, you know, people disagree with their aims or whatever. But the real answer to why Bernie Sanders is because they can.
And I would take just a moment and put yourself in Bernie Sanders' shoes. I mean, he's called himself a socialist. So this person takes over the microphone in a split second. Really, this happened in a split second. We're having a rally. We're talking. I'm up here. I'm not up here. Now someone else is up here. Okay, Bernie, what's your politically correct position to take in this? To take the microphone back from Black Lives Matter? That doesn't sound very good. It doesn't sound very socialistic. To let them take over your rally? Well, Donald Trump said that was kind of weak. I don't know what you do in that situation, but you've got to make a decision right now. And he let him speak and took the consequences, but this is politics. That's the problem is you don't get a chance to go backstage and meet with your handlers and say, you know, it would be a good idea. So if we could we'll do the Black Lives Matter, but we'll mention, you know, you've got to make a decision right now. And he let him go. And now he has to say, was that a good idea or a bad idea? But his core values would be let him go. So are you authentic or not, Bernie?
The reason I even wanted to get into that is I'm kind of curious about the unintended effects of basing your run on the activist wing of the party. Consider another thing. So Lawrence Lessig is a Harvard law professor who's been an advisor to Bernie Sanders and is now running as a protest campaign for president, basically focused purely on campaign finance reform. He says he'll get in office, get that law passed, and then he'll quit. I'm not saying Lessig would win or could even win a single primary. I'm just suggesting it kind of muddles the message when, you know, your own advisors, your natural allies are out there, and it makes Sanders look less like the captain of a movement and more like a passenger on the boat.
Yeah.
I don't think it's going to do too much to him, mainly because he's in the spotlight now. Yeah. It would take a very concerted effort for the mass media to all of a sudden make Lessig a big deal.
Yeah.
And he's... This New York professor is also, I believe, the founder of the Mayday PAC, which is trying to get rid of PACs. So you know that he's not going to have a lot of money.
That should have been called the SOS PAC.
Right. So he won't have the resources. He'll have even fewer resources than Bernie Sanders will. And right now, Bernie Sanders is the other person. You know, he's the one polling, and the media really follows the polls that then kind of creates the polls, and then it's kind of like a circular iterative process. Yeah, it's problematic probably from a grand standpoint, people who are really paying attention to it all, mm-hmm. but for the most part, the average voter probably isn't.
I love that Lessig is in the race. It just sort of, everything comes, so Lessig, you know, his thing is campaign finance, right? He's a crusader on it. I mean, he's got other issues as well, but he wants a constitutional convention to rewrite the Constitution in certain places to make it more democratic, and his whole sort of thing is getting rid of PACs and and making democracy more accessible and less this oligarchy that he believes it's become. So get him on the Democratic side. And then on the other side, we have like a Ronald Strump, who, let's face it, is really just, he just cut out the middleman. Like, we don't need, you know, Koch brothers giving you money if the Koch brother could just run. Yeah. Right? Like, let's just forget it. Like, forget the candidate. Let's just make the donor, like, the candidate and, like, just get to it. So on one side, we've got this, like, thing in its purest form. And on the other side, we've got this person who's so fired up about it that that's his entire campaign. And it seems like this history of campaign finance and speech and Supreme Court decisions have brought us to this moment where we've got this, you know, these sort of two distilled versions of what's happened to us on either side of the debate, at least. And so it's just, I'm totally fascinated by how that's sort of come into being in this year's election.
Okay.
I thought for a minute you said distilled versions.
You said versions. I'm kind of fascinated by the Trump thing.
John?
After that debate, so many people wrote, okay, he was exposed, that's it, thanks a lot, see you later, Trump. And I think the media has a lesson to learn here, which is we'll tell you what's important, we'll tell you what's happening. And I heard on the radio many things that said Trump was exposed, and instead his poll numbers went up. And I'd add that Carly Fiorina, who was not even on the stage, got a tremendous boost from the media, and now the self-fulfilling prophecy is that she's now making a run, that she's becoming important. I think the media is going to have to decide, you know, I don't think Trump has a prayer in the world of being president of the United States, but it's time to step back and refocus and figure out what are we really saying here.
There was some, it wasn't The Onion, but it was some like satirical website that had the headline was like, Trump punches nun, sets puppy on fire, poll number skyrocket. like, there's nothing it can do. Just stop. Every time he does something, people go, is it now? Is it going to happen? Are people going, no, it's not going to. It's not going to happen. After John McCain, everyone was like, oh, for sure. No. Nope. Not a bit. I don't know what it's going to take. I don't know what it's going to take, but it's going to have to be worse than nun punching, apparently.
Carson?
It's defying all political science, theory, everything right now. He just is. Every single, you know, again, pundit, political scientist, everything just looks at him. There's no way that this can continue going. And it's confusing the hell out of me, actually, like what's going on. But there's obviously some sort of really visceral anger on the right about kind of what any of their elected officials are doing. You know, way back when in 2010, a lot after 2010, everything was written about, you know, the governors, the Republican governors are leading the way. Don't look to Washington, look to the states because the governors are leading the way. And it really seemed like the anti-establishment anger was really turned towards Washington. But now what you're seeing with all these very accomplished governors who are running on the Republican side, they're not really catching fire when everyone thought they would be. So it doesn't seem that it's just Washington. It just seems that it's anyone who kind of was at the helm of any government is now being punished by the right. And I just don't see if they continue down this path, which, you know, political science says they won't. And history says they won't. But if they continue down this path, it could be very detrimental to the party, let alone to the country as a whole.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of our podcast listeners emailed me to say that we've, obviously in a number of these programs, spent a lot of time talking about Donald Trump, the phenomenon. But we haven't talked much about what his platform is. So I want to go into that. Now, first of all, you can't really blame us for not going in-depth on his policies. I looked at his campaign website. This is his official campaign website. When you click on the tab for positions, there's one. Seriously, there's just one.
I am the greatest.
Immigration reform. And he lays out his immigration, and you know that, build a wall, make Mexico pay for it, enforce immigration laws that are already on the books. Do we know anything else more about what his actual policies are? I mean,
well,
he doesn't like Megyn Kelly, and he's giving kids... Yeah.
That's under Megyn Kelly tab, like, on his website.
Yeah.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, the interesting thing about the debate was that there was almost no dissension among any of the candidates. Like, I mean, there was a lot of attacks and people, you know, got, you know, a little nasty with each other and okay. But aside from Rand Paul and some foreign policy issues, everyone agreed on everything. It was, oh, he said, I'm going to build, you know, I'll build that wall and Mexico pay for it. And Marco Rubio's like, yes, and ankle monitors. And it was like, okay, let's just, we're going to keep building on that. Like, no one's going to take issue with the wall. We're just going to say what else we're going to do. Right. So actually his stances, you know, wrapped in, you know, interesting delivery as they are pretty well in line with the Republican Party. He was at the debate. He said, I'm against the Iran nuclear deal. Okay. I'm against immigration, or I want to, you know, clamp down on immigration. Okay. He said, you know, we got to get tougher on China, on trade. Okay. I mean, if you sort of peel it all away, there really isn't a lot of daylight between most of those candidates on their actual stances. And I think that's one of the things that's baffling people is the fact that how are people still supporting him? Well, if you get down to it, I mean, he's kind of pretty well your standard Republican in a lot of ways.
I think he also has the advantage of not caring, you know, because, I mean, that very first question at the Fox debate, would you take a pledge not to run against someone? I think they thought that was the gotcha of all gotchas. And I think Donald Trump thought, this is great. I'm going to be the only person in the whole thing. And, you know, I'll explain it later. You know, I don't know how it all works out, but I'll explain it later. He loves the attention. He loves being that person. And I think we're tired of inauthentic candidates and politicians. And he does tap into something. Just like the, I don't agree with him, but I'm glad somebody's finally saying something.
One big caveat, though, basically no one's spent any money yet in any of these early states. Some of the super PACs have to kind of boost their candidate, but no one's really spent any money attacking anyone else yet. Mm-hmm. Donald Trump has a very long history of really very liberal positions across the board, mm-hmm. Not to mention the fact that he's given to Hillary Clinton, who will like most likely be the nominee.
Just so she'd come to his wedding.
Just so she'd come to his wedding. But still, I mean, there's a lot of things for the Republican base to start hearing and saying, wait a minute, even if he does want to build that wall, as Melissa said, most of the other candidates do also. So why do I want to support him when he also wants universal health care, which most Democrats running actually have historically never supported, so besides Bernie. So, I mean, there is time left for the Trump ticking time bomb to go away.
Okay. Well, let me ask the audience, by a show of hands, how many of you watched that recent GOP debate on Fox?
Mm-hmm. I love it.
Yeah, it was the most watched debate, like, since they started watching debates. I mean, it was huge. Now, what did you think about Donald Trump's back and forth with Fox News Channel during and after the debate? The whole accusations that Fox was out to get him, and then he and Fox made up. First of all, is it a news organization's job to have a feud and make up with people, or to, you know, Chuck, does this mean they're not fair and balanced?
Well, first of all, is it a news organization? Let's start with that. I thought their questions were pretty tough, I have to say. They were better than I thought. The start of it was not good at all. But so our question is, what? How far did this go?
Yeah.
You know, I think that the safety factor is so strong in politicians that we're having a difficult time, and I think Bernie Sanders is tapping into this as well, that we'd like to see some other people. I had a very weird... This sounds a little random, but I had a very weird experience 2 weeks ago when I went to cover the fires up in the Rocky Fire. Governor Brown showed up, and he gave a press conference, and I wrote a story about it, and his people were on me immediately. And they said, I cannot believe that you did not mention the fact that Governor Brown was responding to the Republican debate when he said, California is on fire, what the hell are you going to do about it? And I said, well, the whole story talked about, you know, global warming and how concerned you are about it. Yes, but you don't realize that he was responding to the presidential debate. And in fact, he sent a letter to every member of that debate. It just made me think that Governor Brown was very interested in having presidential and Jerry Brown in the same sentence. You just never know in a crazy situation like this. Call me a conspiracy theorist, but
oh
I'm
my
just
God.
Wondering if a lot of people don't see an opening. You know, if this isn't a very fraught election with nobody taking
the oh, my God.
The look on your face, Melissa. I'm sorry the podcast.
Please,
can't
Lord.
See it.
Biden, Gore, Brown. Like,
Carrie,
yeah, let's
Carrie.
Get Dukakis back up there. Let's get... Is Mondale still alive? Let's get him. Good grief. No, they were hard on him in the debate. I mean, that's a fact. But if you look at things like, I remember there was one question for Marco Rubio, and it was like, Marco Rubio, what would you do to help small businesses? What? What kind of layup is that? Like, and he was like, well, I'll tell you, I have my 3-point plan that I've been practicing for 2 days in a hotel room. Okay. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And it was just like, you guys, you're killing me. So they were hard on Trump. And I'm not saying that they were harder on him than some of the other front runners, but they definitely asked him really tough questions. And again, I'm not saying it was even a good idea for him to be such a baby about it. But, you know, when you're the front runner, you're going to get hard questions. But if you look back at the, you know, sort of the list of, like, who got asked what, he got asked consistently really, really difficult questions. Again, maybe rightfully so. But I understood at the end when he was like, wait a minute, they were hard on me. What was not cool is that he was really mad at Megyn Kelly. She was only one of three people who asked really hard questions. There were two other dudes who were also asking hard questions who, you know, also maybe should have been part of that,
pretty tough on him.
That criticism. But to be fair, I mean, there were some candidates who got a lot easier questions than others. I think if you were to go back and if you really hate yourself enough to go back and rewatch it, take note like of how easy or hard the questions were.
Except John Kasich, the Ohio governor, he got probably the hardest question was asking him how to defend his Medicaid expansion in the state of Ohio, when you're standing there on stage with Republicans who've railed against Obamacare since
and
day one.
Very vocal.
I thought he gave a good
yes.
answer, though.
Yeah, and he gave a fantastic answer. And he also got a gay marriage question. I mean, he really one of the only ones on the stage. And he answered that very well as also, where he showed true compassion and understanding, but also kind of stayed true to his personal beliefs, mm-hmm. Which is a very difficult line to follow, especially in a Republican debate with thousands of Republicans sitting there in the audience with you.
Well, I hate to admit that Connor's making sense in a Republican debate that was just nonsense, but that guy could be the dark horse. I feel like he's got a lot of potential. He has a wide-ranging view. You know, someone told me, though, and it's worth Googling, apparently he has a terrible temper. And it's come up more than once, and it could be... I think Donald Trump is going to implode on his own. I don't think it'll be questions... He said it. He said it to Maureen Dowd, you know, in Sunday's New York Times. I go too far. I know I do. He gets so carried away with being clever that he, you know, the Rosie O'Donnell thing was kind of funny, but then when we went to the, you know, Megyn Kelly thing, not so funny. I think that'll happen. But I think he's got a chance. I think that guy could be a contender and maybe a dark horse. He's going to have to raise some money, but I think that could be a real factor.
Jeb Bush needs to watch out for him in New Hampshire.
Oh, Jeb Bush.
And
oh, my God.
He's the biggest threat to Jeb Bush in New Hampshire.
Jeb Bush is calling himself the tortoise because of the tortoise of the hair. I think he looks like a tortoise. Come on, Jeb. Have a cup of coffee or something. You've got to project here a little bit. Come on.
That's true. He doesn't look like he's having much fun.
No.
You know, like, it's like, do you want... Do you
you can't say that on NPR.
Which also is not much fun. But I just mean, like, he's just always like, well, I guess I have to be here. Okay, I'm just going to sort of do this thing. You know what I mean? Like, he doesn't, I mean, the Lord knows certain people want it maybe too much. But he really, you know, he's just kind of looks like sometimes like he's not really enjoying it or, you know, having any, you know, or has this burning desire to be president. And I think that that's okay to say, I really want to be president. I mean, one of the things that bugs me about people when they criticize Hillary Clinton, when they caricature her as being this incredibly ambitious person, I'm like, what's wrong with that? I want somebody who wants to be president, mm-hmm. to be the president. I don't want to have to drag somebody into the White House to run the country. But yeah, he does seem to lack a little bit. She may have an authenticity problem, but he has like an enthusiasm issue, I think.
Well, I would just say this is not a good look. Okay? Straighten your glasses, Jeb. Come on.
Okay, Melissa, you brought up Hillary again. We have a question. How would the Democratic primary change if Hillary is indicted?
For what?
Not at all.
The voice of the people. I just read the question.
Well, to be fair, an indictment is not, a conviction. So I don't mean to split hairs here, but being indicted, you know. We got at least a dozen members of Congress who've been indicted for various things. Would it be a problem? Yes. Having said that, I mean, she really has the money and the endorsements. Like, there's really people, maybe Biden, maybe Gore, maybe Kerry, for God's sakes. But here's the thing. She has really sucked up all the oxygen from the party regular folks, again, in terms of money and endorsements. So there's not a lot left there. If something terrible were to happen and she were to get indicted, I think the party would hold its nose and go for it, partly because whoever's going to be the Republican, if it's Ted Cruz or Ben Carson or Donald Trump, she's still even indicted. I think for a lot of people, a better alternative. So, no, I don't necessarily think that would be fatal. And is that a sad thing that we say? Like, an that indictment, not as bad as, like, money laundering, it's not as bad as that guy with the hooker. That's not that bad. Yeah.
We would call that a ringing endorsement then. Even indicted, she's better. That's good.
There was an article on the political news website, politico.com, about Joe Biden and basically saying he's missed his opportunity, even though he's apparently seriously looking at joining the race. All of the donors or the big donors he would need to get money from, this argument goes, they're not only already spoken for, they're enthusiastically behind Hillary Clinton. They're excited about, the first woman candidate. They've been with her for a long time. Even the ones who had been Obama people they're all in with Hillary Clinton. So someone like Joe Biden, should he actually take that step and enter, his only chance would be as if she drops out, right?
I mean, essentially.
Might be able to be the one of the few to be able to pick up the pieces or try to make the case, just because, he is the sitting vice president. That carries a lot mm-hmm. amongst the establishment, amongst the insiders. It'll be interesting to see how the email situation plays out. It's definitely hurting her. I mean, it's not helping her by any measure. Her favorability numbers are dropping, and that was to be expected when she started campaigning to begin with. But they're dropping a little bit more quickly than most people, I think, thought. And then she has this trouble with the honest and trustworthy question. And the biggest problem for politicians is when they are doing stuff that reaffirms what the public already kind of thinks about them. Mitt Romney's biggest mistake with the 47% comment was it just reaffirmed what people already thought, that he just does not care about the poor. Now, if President Obama had said that for some weird reason, it wouldn't have really stuck to him because people know that he cares. With the email situation, there's already some suspicion about what the Clintons are kind of doing sometimes, and this kind of just plays into that persona that has kind of developed. And when you have 99% name ID, it's kind of hard to combat that. So,
if Bill Clinton were running, say Hillary wasn't interested at all in running, if Bill Clinton somehow could run for a third term,
I was going to say, can he? He might. We're trotting everybody else out. Right. Apparently.
But my point simply being, he'd be a shoo-in. I mean, all that Clinton baggage that people like to talk about, he'd be a shoo-in.
But do people really think he's trustworthy? And that's what I think. Like, these polls are like, do you think they're trustworthy? Like, I don't know if that matters. Like, do we really think that politicians are trustworthy? Do you think any politician is trustworthy? No. Okay, so you're 30%, you're 80%. Like, who cares? Like, we think you're all a bunch of liars. As long as you're a liar on my side. As long as you're a liar who's not going to try to overturn Roe v. Wade, like, we're cool. So it's, people, I think, make a lot about this untrustworthiness and this issue with, credibility. But I think they put too much stock in that, and they don't understand that people are really going for what's aligned with their own interests, and maybe don't care as much about, whether or not they sent an email from a server mm-hmm. 3 years ago that was marked classified in the right way and la, 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 la.
It is complicated, and I think in the back of people's mind there is a sense that Hillary Clinton, I'm not sure we really can trust what she's saying, and maybe this is an example of it, whereas with Bill, I think we made our peace with it. You really can't trust him that much, but he's done a pretty good
but
job.
But that's the thing, is you, but you trust what they do.
Yep.
Right? And so the idea being, you should never listen to a politician what they say. You should only look at what they do. And what she's saying is, look, I have worked tirelessly for peace and income equality. I mean, she's looking at her record, and that's what she's running on. Less so, believe me, I'm great. That's Donald Trump's campaign, which is just, trust me, I'm awesome. That's not her campaign. Her campaign is, trust me, because I've done all these things, and whether or not you believe I'm, you know, what I, you know, whether or not you believe I go and sleep in a coffin, you know, under a basketball court, like, whatever, it doesn't matter. Like, I'm not going to do certain things, and I'm going to protect you from other things.
I did not see the basketball court coming.
I don't know. That was just like, what's the most random?
That was good. Okay. That was good.
Thank
and,
you.
And I think Marco Rubio said that, you know, if it was a resume, Hillary would win. Yeah. The other thing I would say is a little of Joe Biden goes a long way. You know, I mean, I think he definitely wants to do it. He's always wanted to do it. But there's a reason why he hasn't. And even the White House, you saw today, is now like, whoa, Joe, wait, are you sure? You know, they're playing the long game, and they still feel like Hillary's got the opportunity. But I don't know. I think this foregone conclusion thing, I think, is putting people off. They prefer to have a real race, and we're not really having one, so maybe we'll pick somebody to make it a race.
I will add that there's rumors that he would run on a one-term pledge. Worst idea ever. Talk about making yourself a lame duck immediately. Yeah. I mean, you get nothing done whatsoever because the Republicans are going to control at least one chamber of the Congress for the foreseeable future. The Senate might go back and forth, but if you're telling people you're going to be a one-term president already, you might as well just kind of sit back and just take a nap in the Oval Office.
And he shouldn't kid himself, right? Right now, he's, you know, the prom king. Everyone's like, oh, Joe Biden. Yeah. Isn't he charming? Isn't he earthy? Isn't he a man of the people? Isn't he authentic? Isn't he all the things that Hillary isn't? Well, the minute he gets in the race, he's gaffe-prone, you know, never has been, you know, like you go from, you know, that shining, you know, shiny object that we're all interested in to just another candidate who's going to get dragged through the mud. So I'm hoping that his advisors are being realistic with him that, you know, this little, oh, I'm going to dither and everyone can follow me around for a while thing might be fun for him, but ultimately they will turn on him like that as soon as he decides he's going to enter the race, if he decides he's going to enter the race.
And just real quick, just to mix analogies, everybody loves the backup quarterback. You know, it's always that guy. Yeah. If only we had him in there, this wouldn't have happened. And then you get a little dose of him and maybe you don't want him. So,
well, let's move on. First, I'll just remind our listeners and viewers, this is Week to Week, the Political Roundtable at the Commonwealth Club of California. Today's panelists are Melissa Griffin-Kane, C.W. Nevius, and Carson Bruno. Now, let's talk about roads. And why do I want to talk about roads? Well, infrastructure, roads and bridges, across the country have been in sometimes dismal state of repair for years and even decades. By some estimations, Californians' roads are among the worst of the lot. So Carson, you've been writing about this, so give us a bit of a backgrounder here. What's going on? Does California have any plans to deal with it? And how big is the gap between our needs and our actual...
No, California, by most surveys, California is either at the bottom or right there near the bottom for basically everything. You know, pavement conditions, bridge deficiencies.
Really? Not even like Mississippi?
Oh, no. We're the worst. I mean, and just drive around the state. I mean, everywhere you go, from L.A. to in San Francisco to the 5 to everything, is just terrible conditions of the roads. But this has been a problem for a very, very long time. It's nothing new. You know, California used to have it, you know, the finest roads, highway system in the entire country. You can thank Pat Brown, Jerry's father, for that. So what has now kind of popped up recently is that, you know, Caltrans, the transportation agency, has basically gone to the legislature and said, look, we need $6 billion more just to maintain the current state of the roads.
Are these the same people who put the bolts in the Bay Bridge?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
So talking about trusting the politicians.
Two very different projects.
One time.
No, very different.
This is $6 billion annually, every single year. The American Society of Civil Engineers actually puts it at $10 billion annually to maintain the roads. So we're talking about a lot of money. What was most interesting, however, is so they came to Jerry Brown and legislature, you know, at the beginning of the budget the negotiations way back in January and told them this. The money didn't make it into the budget at all. You know, Governor Brown, you know, meets with Kevin De Leon, the Senate President Pro Tem, and Tony Atkins, the Senate, Assembly Speaker. They hash everything out, and they boost transportation spendings, the special funds and the general funds, by about 1% or 2% more than what you would have seen maybe a few previous years. So they really didn't do too much to transportation. But immediately right after the budget was signed by Jerry Brown, he called a special session to deal with the funding gap. People like me think, well, wait a minute, you just went through budget negotiations. That's the funding priority.
Yeah,
that's the funding document. So it's obvious that he had taxes in mind, and so did the Democratic leadership had taxes in mind.
New taxes,
despite the fact that we're at record revenue levels, signed the biggest budget in the California history. So there's money to be had in the state budget. They just did not decide to prioritize it enough. So now we're in the midst now with the legislature back in session as of today, of them starting to hash out all these various special session bills, which could last actually forever. There's no end date to a special session. So it's kind of whenever the governor kind of deems that the emergency has been resolved. Tony Atkins in the Assembly and then Silicon Valley's own Jim Beal, state senator from Silicon Valley, both proposed two ways to meet the funding gap. Surprise, surprise, all taxes. Raising the gas tax, the vehicle license fee, the vehicle registration fee, creating new road user fees. Nothing really going on there. The Assembly, or the GOP side, is actually kind of using this as a way to kind of highlight their differences rather wisely, because they need to use any sort of opportunity to kind of highlight why they should get one more seat, in the legislature. And they're trying to find the money via reforms by trying to reform Caltrans, which has been an abysmal state agency for quite some time. The Bay Bridge just kind of highlights that issue. So they're trying to find the money elsewhere without raising any new taxes. Mm-hmm. So it'll be interesting to see how happens. Of course, two-thirds majority to pass a tax, which means the Democrats need some Republicans in both chambers to pass a tax.
Yeah.
So it gives the Republicans a lot of leverage in this special session moving forward to try to demand some of these government reforms that that they proposed thus far. Whether they get any new taxes is a whole another issue. I don't think they would. I think that would be the way to kill Republicans' advances in the Assembly and Senate that they've made. But crazier things have happened in Sacramento, so who knows?
Chuck, I'm always thinking that there's kind of a two-sided thing here. We complain when our roads are really, really bad.
Yes.
And then you've driven or been driven around San Francisco lately. I mean, I've actually given up going to places because every route I try to take is multiple road construction and things. So we're upset when the roads are bad, and then we're also upset when someone is fixing the roads.
Right, and when someone's raising taxes to fix our our roads, my wife always says it's like buying underwear. We know we have to do it, but it's not that exciting, But yeah, I mean, Barack Obama said that too. Nationally, was it really that funny? I'll tell her. She really liked that. That's good. He mentioned that with the infrastructure nationally. I mean, the bridges and so forth. It's a very, it's definitely a concern. It's something we want to do. And, yeah, San Francisco is exhibit A. I mean, just going from one side of town to the other, when do you ever not encounter a tremendous traffic jam? But it's essential. It's part of the infrastructure. It's part of the quality of life. When you do these things, that's why you need inspirational politicians to convince you this is a good idea, pay a little more, our quality of life will improve. But it's a tough sell in a no-tax kind of political situation.
Well, the problem, though, is, for example, San Francisco. I'll give you a perfect example. San Francisco, we get money from the state, and then it's supposed to go to our roads. It's supposed to be for infrastructure things. But every year they take it and they put it towards the MTA. They put it toward Muni. And so, and then you go, oh, well, where's the money? Well, it was there, but you didn't prioritize it, and you took it all and you gave it over to this other transportation issue instead of dealing with actual paving and fixing things. And I think, I believe at the state we have a similar issue, which is, well, there's twofold. Number one, the more you encourage fuel efficient vehicles, the less gas you sell, the less gas tax you bring in. So we're at our environmental, you know, aims are a little bit at odds with our revenue collection aims in that regard. The second thing is, if I recall correctly, a lot of the money that is coming in from this gas tax is not going to fixing roads. It's going to things like high-speed rail and other issues and other kinds of transportation issues. So it's not just necessarily an issue like, oh, we don't have the money. It's like, you do have it. You got to prioritize it, and you have to decide, are you going to actually fix the road, which is what we thought that this money was supposed to go to, or are you going to take it and spend it on this other mass transit? Now, and again, there's good debates on either side of that, but the idea that, oh, what are we going to do in a, like, bajillion-dollar budget? Where are we going to come up with it? I don't know. We're going to have to tax some more. No. You know, it was there. We're spending it on different kinds of priorities.
So just to be clear, you're saying San Francisco doesn't sometimes spend money in a logical way?
Chuck, I know. Brace yourself. I know this is going to be tough.
Oh my God.
For you to handle, but sometimes money comes in and we give it to things that it's not intended to go
to. What are you talking about?
I know. I'll hug you later.
Thank you.
To Melissa's point, by some estimates, just 20% of the money statewide that is dedicated to road and bridge maintenance actually gets to road and bridge maintenance. The rest of it gets divvied up to other transportation issues, which includes Caltrans employing 3,500 more people than it actually needs to employ.
You explained in your article why I thought that was interesting.
Yeah.
And it has to do with them.
So Caltrans is a project maintenance sort of workforce. I mean, whenever there's a project, they have to ramp up their staffing to be able to handle that project. But then when they staff, you know, full-time public employees, it's very hard to get rid of them when the projects then disappear. So as projects then kind of ramp down, then they're left with all of these full-time employees that have nothing to do, but that they're getting paid full-time and plus benefits and everything like that. So
couldn't they give them harnesses and say, you're checking bridge bolts today?
Right. And, you know, it might be one thing if, you know, those 35 extra, you know, 100 people were actually doing their job, but time after time after time, we see these projects not getting done properly. And cost overruns and the whole shebang. So, you know, it's one thing if the agency was actually doing its job, doing it effectively, efficiently, but that's not even, they don't even have that to kind of fall back on either. So,
okay. Well, let's try to get in a few more short things before we go to the news quiz. I know some folks think it's too early to talk about the 2016 election, so you're going to really love this. Let's talk briefly about the political landscape in California for the 2018 election. And it's worth talking about because for a while it was looking like this was a foregone conclusion. Gavin Newsom was the inevitable candidate. Carson, stuff's happening there. What's going on?
I just start off. I'm just amazed about the lack of activity on the 2016 front on the U.S. Senate race. The first time that one of California's two U.S. Senate seats has been open in 20 plus years. So it's just a lot of pent up energy and enthusiasm in a very deep Democratic bench in a very significant, safe Democratic state. So I'm amazed by that. But what you're starting to see now is everything, all those people who might have gone after Boxer's seat are now turning their attentions to 2018. And looking at Jerry Brown being termed out, the possibility of Dianne Feinstein retiring in 2018, which means you have an open Senate seat then. Mm-hmm. It just seems like for everyone, 2016 was a little bit too soon to kind of get everything running, up and running. So they kind of want to put on the brakes and kind of get out there, fundraise, kind of feel out the networks, and kind of run for 2018. So what you're seeing is, you know, Gavin has already jumped in. We know what he's doing. He's fundraising like crazy to try to scare people off, but yeah, it doesn't seem to be working because you have Steve Wesley, a former state controller, billionaire from Silicon Valley, jumping in. He doesn't need the fundraise. He can self-fund. Tom Steyer is definitely making a move. He's been making a lot of plays on the gas price issue and now income inequality. Again, another billionaire who can self-fund. He doesn't have to fundraise. Who else? John Chung, the state treasurer, has now announced that he is running, and he has a lot more statewide experience than Gavin Newsom does, so he is definitely a threat to Newsom. You have Antonio Villaraigosa, you have possibly Eric Garcetti, you have Sheryl Sandberg. So the list just keeps on going on and on and on. And you're like, wow, people really want to be governor, and they do not want to go to Washington, D.C. Like, they choose Sacramento over Washington, D.C. So it's quite amazing. And even on the Republican side, Ashley Swearingen, the mayor of Fresno, Kevin Falconer, the mayor of San Diego, two very viable candidates, especially in the whole top two situation where you have, you know, six, seven, eight Democrats running, could kind of create some exciting times in June 2018, whether a Democrat can make it in.
On the much shorter horizon, time-wise, San Francisco has an election coming up this fall. Mayor Lee, of course, he's got some opposition, but I challenge you to name any of them.
Are any of them here?
Yes.
Okay.
If you are, I didn't mean that as an insult.
We talked about this one time, and we were saying, oh, there's no opposition. And one guy's like, I'm running. Oh, my God. I'm so sorry. So, okay, good. They're not here.
But I have to
ask. He really has, like, no real opposition.
We know the nude guy's not here, at least.
The naked guy, yes.
The naked guy's not here, so okay.
Okay. Well, I have to ask. What did you make of the accusations by the lawyer for Shrimp Boy that Mayor Ed Lee was on the take?
Okay.
Does that have any political implications, or do you not take that?
Wow. So I don't know if you read you guys are all smarty pants, so you might have read the legal filing by Shrimp Boy Chow's lawyer. It was crazy. It was crazy. And I'm not saying that Shrimp Boy wasn't railroaded or whatever, but legally speaking, so the argument was selective prosecution. Basically said, you know, everybody's on the take and you just went after my guy, and that is why my guy should, the whole thing should be dismissed. Like, dismiss all the charges because you selectively prosecuted my guy. But the problem is, selective prosecution is based on the constitutionally protected things, right? So if there are 10 people involved in a conspiracy and you only prosecute, like, the black guy, then that's an issue. That's a selective prosecution, right? And you can actually move to have something dismissed because that's a violation of the Equal Protection Clause in the Constitution. But it's things like race, gender, ethnicity. That's kind of the grounds for selective prosecution that you have to assert. So in this filing, he says, my client was selectively prosecuted because he's awesome. Because he is so great. I actually have the quote right here. He is a real-life superhero. It's from the thing. You're like, that is not a legal grounds for selective prosecution. Like, sir. So I mean, obviously it wasn't on the grounds of gender or ethnicity. I mean, you had other, you know, Chinese persons who like Ed Lee, who's alleging got off scot-free. So he couldn't name like any, you know, any actual protected ground. So he just said, you know, my client is just the greatest. And that is why he was chosen. You had to knock him down because he was delivering services to the community that the government couldn't, which, you know, arguably that's illegal. But that was the actual argument. So it was like, legally speaking, I mean, everyone was like, oh my goodness, this, you know, this crazy, you know, look at this filing. But it was like, legally speaking, like, it's nonsense. And I was like, I'm not even sure like the other side's going to even like file something in opposition. Sometimes things are so crazy that you just go, you know, I don't need to oppose that. Like, it's just kind of, it's kind of its own thing. Like, I'm just going to let the judge deal with that. I'm not going to get involved. So I'm not even sure if the prosecution even like filed anything. On the issue of Mayor Lee, there were some quotes in there from wiretaps where people were saying Ed Lee knows about this. So there was nothing that directly implicates Ed Lee. And I'm not saying that nothing exists that implicates Ed Lee. I'm not saying he's, you know, a choir boy, but I'm saying in the filing, it was all a lot of hearsay. It was like Ed Lee Edley knows, and people were like invoking his name and kind of name dropping, frankly. And so, but that was as close as it came. It didn't really get to any sort of direct evidence of that. So even though like it was all over the news, oh, they, you know, they allege Edley dirty. There was really, Edley's campaign was like, eh. And because there really wasn't much to it. Again, in the filing, whatever investigation is going to lead wherever it goes. But as far as the what they were able to produce on the wiretap, there was really not a lot there. This whole thing seemed to be really blown out of proportion.
Okay.
So I can't believe we've gone this long without mentioning that Melissa is possibly going to be arguing in front of the Supreme
Court.
Oh,
my God. I'm going to kill you.
That's it.
Melissa,
I'm going
lawyer,
to kill you.
What I, you know, my, I'm not an attorney by any stretch of the imagination, but my sense of Shrimp Boy, which was my nickname in high school, if I could just.
I can see that.
You know, it doesn't look good for Shrimp Boy. I mean, he's got a lot of things going on, but the fact is the FBI cast, in the mildest terms, a very wide net. I mean, they went after Joe Montana. They tried to get him to take. So if you're a Shrimp Boy, you better just throw as much stuff up in the air as you possibly can. And that's my non-legal impression of what's going on.
That's pretty good.
Don't you think?
Yeah, that's good.
I mean, I'm sure he's got some real problems, and I don't know that Ed Lee is one of them. I think he's, you know, the fact that Ed Lee hardly reacted, I think, was probably shrewd.
Okay. Well, before we do the news quiz, I have to say, lots of great questions. Thank you. Obviously, I didn't get to all that many of them. But someone did submit a question for you, so I'm going to ask you. They wanted us to take a poll of everyone here. So raise your hand if you think Bernie Sanders will still be in the race after Iowa and New Hampshire. In other words, he's in it for a while. That's nearly unanimous. Okay, well, let's do a news quiz. For those one or two of you who have never been here for our live news quiz, I'll quickly explain it. I'm going to ask a question. If you think you know the answer, raise your hand. Please don't just shout it out. I'll pretend I can't hear it. I'll point at you, and you can then shout it out. And if you are correct, Fran will deliver some Ghirardelli chocolate to you. So, So, the first question is, where did both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump go over the weekend, they went to the same place, to greet prospective voters? Back in the corner there. That's right, the Iowa State Fair. Next, let's stay with the candidates. Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton picked up an endorsement this past week that will be helpful as she contests the Iowa caucuses. Who endorsed Clinton? Sir? Sorry? Senator Tom Harkin, that's correct. He's, of course, the U.S. Senator from Iowa. He joined her at the Iowa State Fair, by the way. Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, and other Democrats took part in a wingding. What is a wingding? Anybody know? Did you see this? Okay, I thought you might have caught that. It's a Democratic fundraiser and speaker program that were, you know, in Iowa, of course. The next one. Billionaire Donald Trump has a new job today. What is it? You already won, so I'm going to... Ma'am, I think I saw your hand next. He's on jury duty. That is correct. I do not know yet what kind of case, but what did Donald Trump say would lead to a nuclear holocaust? And sorry,
the approval of the Iran deal.
That is correct. He said the Iran nuclear deal would lead to a holocaust. Okay, a San Francisco politician is proposing that police make what traffic crime a very low priority? This is a sir in the front. Sorry?
Bicycle.
More specifically?
Bicycles are banging the same laws as cars.
We'll give it to you. It's bicyclists going through stop signs. For people who don't like bicycle lists, I guess this will be like Darwinism. Next question. What country did the United States warn against sending its agents into American soil, onto American soil, to pressure fugitives to return home. Sir, your hand was up before I was even done with the question.
China.
That's right, China. 54 people died after a plane crashed on a mountain in what country? Way back in the corner there. That's right. Yes, did you... Fran, wait back there in the corner. It was in Indonesia. Abenomics suffered a setback as the economy shrank in what country? In the blue, in the, toward the back there?
Japan.
That's right, Japan. Abenomics, named after Prime Minister Abe. And where are we? I think we have two more. Political comedian John Oliver, if you've seen him on HBO, used to be on The Daily Show. He has been a vocal critic of tax exemptions for religious organizations. What has he just done to make his point? Sir, right there.
Maybe I missed the question, but the sports stadiums, public funding of sports stadiums.
No. Ma'am, toward he is starting his own church. He's calling it Our Lady of Perpetual Exemption. And our final question for this week, sfgate.com, where Chuck works, they highlighted a one-bedroom penthouse apartment in San Francisco that's renting for how much a month? Sir, is it, ma'am, I'm sorry.
$6,500.
That's right, $6,500. Yes, that's... Well, listen, we're going to have more news quiz questions and a lot more to discuss on Tuesday, September 15th in Palo Alto when we return to Silicon Valley. Then we'll be back in San Francisco in early October. Thank you to our panel, Carson Bruno, Melissa Griffin-Kane, and Chuck Medias. Thanks to all of you here, everyone watching us on TV and listening online.